Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is the podcast where we engage with colourful little cardboard oblongs for longer and with closer attention than is strictly necessary as we attempt to understand the memories, meanings and stories held by picture postcards. I'm Tom Jackson, and today I'm delighted to say my guests are writers in very different fields, Thane Prince and Toby Matthew. Thane and Toby, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Now, Thane Prince, you'll know as a food writer for the Daily Telegraph and elsewhere. You'll have seen her on Ready, Steady, Cook, The Big Allotment Challenge, heard her on Woman's Hour, or you might well have read her work in one of over a dozen books she's written, many with an emphasis on jams and preserves and pickles and stuff you put in jars.
Yes, very much so.
And Thane comes to us today with a W1 postmark?
Yes, absolutely. I arrived here when I was 18, and I've, apart from 3 years living in America, I've tried really hard not to move outside Zone 1, so W1.
Well, that's a luxury if you can make it happen. Well done for you. Now, Thane, do you still send postcards?
I still buy postcards. I'm really quite rubbish at sending them. I spend a lot of time in Spain these days because I cook abroad. And I do buy postcards and send them to my mother and to my husband's brother and occasionally to my grandchildren. But I'm afraid I'm not an inveterate postcard seller.
Just the buyer.
I buy them because the pictures are so much more vibrant than anything I can take, and you can keep them and store them. And also, I think the photography is just more apt. And sometimes you can get pictures of the place as it was. You know, I like buying old postcards.
Yes. So by definition, they're older than what you would have taken with
today.
A camera.
Yes,
because
of course.
Whether it's months or years.
That's right.
Very good. Now, Toby Matthew is a writer and historian specialising in Russian graphic art and propaganda. Working as a journalist for the Associated Press, he lived in Russia and Ukraine for 3 years. And while he was in Russia, he started picking up old postcards, a primrose path. Soon, he had an impressive collection of revolutionary postcards. And the good news is, Toby shares his amazing collection and the story of those cards and events around them in his beautiful book, Greetings from the Barricades, which is actually the first major study, I think, of design, production, distribution of anti-Tsarist postcards. And a kind of lens through which to look at that whole period, I suppose.
Absolutely. It's extraordinary. These tiny objects really reflect a whole revolutionary history. And when I first came across them, I thought, you know, here are amazing, dynamic, vibrant images. And then slowly starting to uncover the stories behind them, I went down, shall we say, a slippery slope.
I know that slope. Well, Toby comes to us today with a slightly blurry postmark. I mean, I think, like Thane, it might be London, but there's a hint of Moscow in there as well.
I think that's absolutely right. Born in London, moved out, but I've spent many of my formative years in Moscow, having lived there for 3 years or so.
So would the postmark have a code on it, like we have here in Roscoe?
Yep, numeric code, possibly forwarded, so lots of good cancellation marks.
They're the best.
Absolutely.
The whole history, the palimpsest at the back of a postcard. And Toby, when did you last send a postcard?
Just yesterday.
Good work.
Little thank you note for a lovely holiday in Ireland. So yeah, I'm a very keen sender of postcards. They're so easy and people appreciate them.
Very good. Well, you'll find no argument from me in that. Now, before we discover the cards that Toby and Thane have brought along, I'll give you a quick card of mine. This is, of course, a postcard from the past card, like I do on Twitter, at Past Postcard, and in the book. It's an old card from which I've selected just a bit of the message. So he will start with this. This is a rather good card, actually. Let me read it. It's Clacton on Sea, and it's incredibly oversaturated colours. The sky's never been that blue, I don't
not
think.
Not in Clacton.
But, you know, not anywhere, I don't think.
No,
not with that
not
richness.
Anywhere. No.
And what's
no.
that, 70s?
I can probably tell you. I think it might be a bit later. No, you can't see the date. I think it's 80s because it's 16p stamp, but the picture is doubtless a good 10 years earlier. And it was sent to Bermondsey from someone called Lorraine, and it just tells you their what their interests are, I suppose. Really, it says, "My money is mostly gobbled up in money machines, and I also went on an aeroplane." So I guess they mean one-armed bandits.
I was going to say all those things you put pennies in and try and get all those pennies to slide towards you.
Well, you can literally see your money disappearing.
You can, absolutely.
And the aeroplane part?
Well, I don't know. Where would you have gone on a plane from Clacton?
Fun ride?
Maybe a light aeroplane.
Oh, yes, you think a real aeroplane?
Oh, I would think so.
Yeah. But not going anywhere in particular, I'd have thought.
No, they'd have probably said. Just going up and down, just
yes.
going for a...
Oh, interesting. Perhaps with some message flapping around the
yes.
back. All right, I'll do another quick one. This is Rye. I'm sure we all know Rye.
Yes.
Yeah. A great sort of civilised day trip place, or a place you might go and stay.
Tea rooms.
Tea rooms, exactly. And just wandering down Mermaid Street. Anyway, this person in 1975, August 1975, Margaret, who was sending it to some friends in Chelmsford, didn't have such a great time on the trip. The car caught fire at Dartford. So not such a good trip for Margaret. To let you know at home, images of all the cards we discussed today are on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can investigate for yourself and see that we're not making it up. Now, Toby and Thane, you've been kind enough to come to the studio today with postcards of your own. Thane, we've bundled some together.
Yes.
But I think these first cards you've got are very much your biography.
So, they
or,
are.
Or perhaps an early part of your biography.
A very early part,
yes. What have you got?
Well, I've got a picture of the cliff path in Old Hunstanton, because I grew up in Hunstan. I was born in Hunstan, which is North Norfolk, and every day during the summer, my mother would put a loaf of bread and some butter and jam and cheese into a box, put it in the pram with my younger sister, and we would all walk down this path and go onto the beach. And we would
very
spend
good.
Every single summer's afternoon that we could. And I think it's because I grew up in the 50s, and therefore, you know, that was what you did. You went outside if you possibly could. And it's a very nostalgic card for me. In fact, this was taken before I was there, because I can see there's a ruined church, which was much more ruined by the time I was a child. And I left there when I was 13, so I found this card in I think I was just sorting through a boot sale and thought, oh, and I think there is something wonderful about seeing an old card of something that you knew as a child. So that's my first card.
And that, so you grew up at the seaside?
Yes.
So would it be the kind of place where they would have sold a lot of postcards for visitors?
Yes, absolutely. And I have sort of memories of the, you know, the Skegness is so bracing type of
right,
cards, you know, the slightly rude ones.
Yeah, cheeky
and,
postcards.
Yes, lots and lots of postcards. I don't suppose we really sent cards very much if you lived at the seaside. You know, you're not sending them.
It's a busman's holiday.
It's a busman's holiday. But yes, lots of postcards, lots of postcard shops. And there was, of course, a fun fair. You know, there was a pier. And I believe there still is at Hunstan.
Hence your knowledge of one-armed bandits.
Absolutely. Yes. Because my mother was a bit above us going on the pier,
right.
as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And no candy floss, because we were all going to get polio and all that sort of thing. You have to think back a long way to all of this.
But you did have the benefits of the open air and the sea breezes
we did.
On the cliff
yes, we
there.
Did. And of course, if anyone visited us, then they all wanted to go on the pier. Mm. So we used to look forward to visitors, because then you could go on the
good
pier and have the candy floss.
Yes, yes. And
yes.
you've got a ready-made attraction for your visitors as
you
well.
You have a ready-made attraction.
Great for cousins and aunts.
Absolutely.
And...
So, yes. No, we definitely went on slot machines, and we definitely had... And it was I loved it. I think it was quite tedious in those post-war years for adults. There wasn't a lot going on. I think it had been a very, very interesting seaside town between the wars with lots of dinner dances and all that sort of thing. But, you know, the East Coast was pretty bad.
A lot of seaside towns have been fairly depressed for quite a long time.
That's right. Yeah.
But there's a bit of a revival literally in the last 10 years or so, actually, isn't
I think
there?
So.
Very much so. I was down in Hastings just the other day and very popular. I have to say, I have not yet been to Hunstanton, but I will certainly go.
When you go? Yes, I think Hunstanton suffered from the loss of the railway link, the beaching.
Oh, gosh.
Because they
a terrible thing to have to happen to a town, isn't
it? Yes. I mean, I went to school on a steam train.
Did you?
Yes, I did. Goodness. There are few people that will sit in the students, and I went to school on a steam train.
I'm jealous.
I went to the grammar school in Lynn, and I got the 8:05 steam train from Hunstanton to Lynn. Yes, for the first 2 years.
And sorry, I can't help notice your elision of Hunstanton to Hunston.
Yes.
So is that like sort of Daventry, Daintree?
Yeah,
that proves you're a local.
It proves I'm a local. And of course, one of the things that caused a problem was that if you stop the train going directly, then people, you know, not everybody has cars, it starts getting awkward.
So
I think the improved transport links, places like Hastings, have been made enormous difference.
Yes. Sure. Mm.
And just to stick on this card for 1 minute.
Yes.
Do we know the date of it? Do we know anything about it? I know you bought it secondhand, so you don't have a personal connection.
No, and I can't see in here, but it's got a George stamp on it, has it?
Yeah, I'm trying to see the date. Mm. It's got a message.
It has got a message.
We leave here on Wednesday and hope to see you next Saturday. We'll let you know the time.
I told you very transport useful. Was difficult. Yeah.
Very hot weather. Place very full. So they're sending it to Essex. So they're on holiday, I think. They've gone up the coast.
Yes, they've gone up the coast.
Very disappointing, no mention of the enormous dog on the front.
I know, there's an enormous
dog. Is it a dog?
Well, it's that or a pony. I mean, it could be a lot.
Looks like a sort of rock.
No, I think it's a collie.
Yeah.
It's a collie.
Yeah, it's a massive collie.
There's a trick of perspective, because it does look enormous.
It does look enormous, yes. So perhaps the photographer wasn't quite as skilled, unless he wanted to keep...
But it makes the card.
It does make
the brilliant. Card.
Well, you need a bit of interest there, otherwise it's just green.
It is, yeah,
that's sort of rather basic printing needs to do, these slabs of colour.
Yes.
You need something going on.
And, of course, the lighthouse and the lighthouse keepers and the RNLI, because, of course, it was a very dangerous coast, and especially when this, you know, this is a Between the Wars postcard, but it became even more pertinent.
Very good. So then your life progresses into the next cards.
It does, the next cards. After a brief stop in Peterborough, I then moved to London, to WM, where I trained as a nurse at the Middlesex Hospital. It's not there.
And these, very close to where we're recording
very,
today.
Very close, yes. So this is really the sort of place that I grew up in, this whole area. And these are the beautiful cards that were on the walls. These cards commemorate the murals in the front hall of the hospital. So you would go into the hospital, which was built in about 18-something, and it was in the traditional H shape. So you have the central block, and then you have the wards, male and female, front and back, Nightingale wards, you know, with sisters sitting at the desk and 15 or 20 beds around the walls. And in the front hall, there were these wonderful, to my mind, wonderful pictures of people. Yes, and they are now in the Wellcome Museum.
Oh, are they?
Yes.
Are they on display?
And they're called Act of Mercy. Yes, they are on display in the Wellcome Museum. And this, it's obviously before the National Health. And these are, in fact, orphans. For my entire life, I thought they were nurses, but they're not. The pictures are of orphans.
They're wonderfully 1920s, that sort of stylized flat colour.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a Burne Jones that looks very similar, which is of the girls walking down a staircase.
Yes, there's something Burne Jones about them.
Very Burne Jones.
Am I right to say there's a sort of Italianate feel? There's something about the colouring.
Well,
they sort of
I think
feel like a
also that column and the entrance there does look as if this could be in Italy. And I mean, I'm not saying it isn't.
Yes, no, that's very true. And that sort of refectory there.
Yes, that's right.
It does look Italianate.
But it was Frederick Kylie Robinson. Is that right? Have I got that right? It's quite dark in here.
Yeah, Kylie Robinson.
Kylie Robinson, yes, that's right. And they are at the Wellcome Museum, and they are very beautiful. And I walked past them every day for probably the 7 or 8 years I was working as a nurse there.
So that bit of public art was... Did it inspire you? Did it lift you a bit?
I think it was some... I think really beautiful things always do. And these were very beautiful. I mean, they were huge. They're big because they were in the main entrance, and there was a dado rail, and then they went up to the ceiling. So they're very big pieces of art. So they're very omnipresent. I'm not sure you see them every time, but you see them enough to imprint on your sort of retina and in your head.
It's a nice philosophy, having something like that, isn't it?
It is a very nice philosophy, yes. And they are called acts of mercy, which, of course, the hospital was built by public donation. And, so, you know, we forget in these days of the NHS. The NHS and I are the same age, but we forget that it was extraordinary before the NHS. Mm. That, you know, it was all about people giving philanthropy.
Yes, yes. And, in fact, to sort of put everything through the lens of postcards, there are many collectors who collect sort of pre-NHS hospital cards.
Yes.
Quite interesting and sometimes quite grim-looking.
Yes.
But
including of patients and...
Yeah, wards. You get a lot of images. Sometimes wards with patients, sometimes empty wards.
Right.
But, I mean, the ones that I've seen of the London Whitechapel Hospital in their sort of what we would now call the emergency department, A&E casualty, and these are really quite grim.
Yes, sort of looks like a war zone.
It does look like a war zone.
Or a sort of First World War hospital or something. Uh-huh. Gosh, well, I shall go to the Wellcome Museum. I'm going to have a look at these because I'm inspired to see them, definitely.
They're very beautiful.
Especially the hospital is no longer there.
No, it isn't.
Everyone was cured. It's fine.
We're all gone. It's okay. We were successful.
Did your job. And no longer had to be a nurse.
So I know, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely fine.
Very good. Oh, well, thank you for inspiring me with those. That's really interesting. Now, Toby, what's the first little bundle you have for us? You're obviously, you know, we're going to draw on your great Russian collection. So let's talk us through it.
So I brought along two postcards from 1906. The first one is of a rather aggressive-looking chap who is a butcher, and the title is Monarchist.
Okay.
Butchers were known at this stage, quite unusual, actually, little-known fact, that butchers in Tsarist Russia were big monarchist supporters.
Really?
Don't ask me why.
I was going to say, that is something I would never have imagined.
I have no idea, but...
Were they wealthy? I mean, relatively?
I don't think comparatively. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, this was working class support for the Tsar.
Right.
And obviously this works on two levels. The pro-Tsarist supporters of its time had an appalling reputation for violence against revolutionaries, against anyone who they didn't agree with, or certainly didn't like their own hero. And this card was produced commercially. And actually one of the odd things about an awful lot of postcards at this time, revolutionary postcards, they're actually produced to raise money, either for individuals, commercial institutions, or for revolutionary parties. This was a private manufacturer who produced it, and it's a very powerful image. It does exactly what it says on the tin. And
so is the producer cashing in on the interest in revolutionary thought? He's not raising funds for the revolutionaries?
No. So it's exactly that. So in 1905, you get a huge upsurge of violence that lasts for about a year and a half. And during this period, you get hundreds of thousands of postcards, if not millions, produced. Right.
This is extraordinary. I mean, I had absolutely no idea about this.
So the very strange thing when I first came across these things was to discover there hasn't been a great deal written on them. And the images speak for themselves, I mean, quite apart from the stories behind them. And actually what I've always been interested in, I think this brings you straight back into your podcast, is the individuals who stand behind them, and whether that's the artists, whether it's the people who sent them, or whether it's the people who actually got money from them. And this card is great. It really appeals to my sense of the absurd and sense of humour, because the message on the back of this really quite bloody image is, "I've got tickets for Carmen on Friday, bel étage. All the best, Lutin." And he's obviously writing to his bell to say, "Got tickets for the opera."
The opera in Moscow?
In Moscow.
And
so
Carmen,
presumably the Bolshoi. And Carmen as well.
Yes, romantic and Spanish and French.
And joyous, you
yes,
know.
Yes, up to a point.
Well, yes, I know. I mean,
the music is.
Someone always dies at the end. The woman always dies.
They are. Well, hopefully not in this case. But
so do you think they were just literally pulling a card off the shelf? Oh, I bought this the other day. I'll use it to send the message. Or were they so wrapped up in revolutionary fever that they... couldn't use any other card? Or
if I've got my academic hat on, I'd say one way of looking at it is that it speaks to the ubiquity of violence at the time, that actually it was perfectly normal to send this sort of violent imagery to someone you knew quite well and that it was no problem. I think what's more likely is that actually it's both. And what we're seeing here is someone who says, probably not that appropriate, but it's fine, it's all I've got, and sent it off. Wildly inappropriate messages written on the back of strange postcards.
It seems to be something about postcards, that the front and the back don't marry, and that's half the shimmering tension of them and the joy of them.
So, I mean, I've got another card in my collection, which is an image of an aftermath of the pogrom, a horrendous image, and someone's written on the back, "Happy Name Day."
Oh my goodness.
And you just think, you know, what is going on here? And I think that really is a case of someone just thought, you know, here's a card, send it.
Yes. And it's unusual for cards in your collection, or it's unusual, I believe, for some of your cards to be written on. They're not a great many revolutionary cards were sent in under plain wrapper.
That's exactly right. I mean, and for obvious reasons, an awful lot weren't sent because they were illegal. You got a change in the census law late in 1905, and that enables an awful lot of private manufacturers to start producing comparatively mild images legally. And this would have been produced legally because, although it's broadly offensive to Tsarist supporters, it's not actively against the government.
Right, so it's a stereotype rather than a sort
it's
of
a stereotype.
Specific attack.
It's a commentary, and actually this is part of a set of seven cards, all of which mock various aspects. So you've got ones mocking revolutionaries. Exactly that. Exactly that.
Wow.
So, I mean, dare I say it, I think it's quite a fun thing.
Yes. Yeah. And presumably you've researched and found out who was performing in Carmen that week.
I think you overestimate my ability as a researcher.
Yes, come back when you have, Tim.
Yes, yeah. And alas, I couldn't find out who the people it was addressed to or who sent it either. So, goodness knows what happened to them.
But that's a great story.
Absolutely. And, it's a very violent card, isn't it?
It's not nice. I mean,
it's a grotesque image, isn't it?
It's not nice.
Yeah, he's a real thug.
But with his hands, his fists clenched and the knives in his apron.
And let's not get away from the fact that, you know, this was a really turbulent, difficult time in Russian history. And you get horrendous anti-Semitic attacks, anti-revolutionary attacks on both sides. You also get the revolutionaries carrying out appalling terrorist attacks as well.
I was reading the sort of chapters that deal with this specific time just this morning, rereading, I might add. And the laws about the postcards were changing, what you couldn't publish, were changing very, very rapidly. So week by week, things seemed to change.
It's hugely complicated, but really from the 1860s onwards, you start getting a print industry that was originally producing only a very small amount of books for the elite, massively expanding. And under the pressure of increased literacy and a burgeoning middle class, you get huge pressures on the system, and the Tsarist government had to react, and did arguably quite slowly. And this came to a pressure both on the censorial front and, of course, on the social front in 1905.
Very good. Well, let's put our unpleasant butcher to one side
yes.
for a minute. And you've got an even worse image for us now.
Oh, gosh.
I'm so sorry. I'm really lowering the tone.
Far from it.
I think you're levelling it.
You're taking us to the depths in some ways, though.
I know. I mean, I think one has to be realistic about this. This is an image of, it's a two-part image of Tsar Nicholas II, produced around the same time as the other card. And on the left-hand side, we see Tsar Nicholas dancing on a pyramid of skulls, and behind him, a whole array of gibbets. And on the right, we see Nicholas II himself hanging from a gibbet.
It's sort of structured a bit like a Punch cartoon or something, isn't it?
Yes.
But my God, it's dark.
Mm.
The caption reads, two perspectives. And on the left, we've got a comment on field martial law that was brought in to counter the revolutionaries. And on the right, very simple one-word caption that in English translates slightly longer, is, it will all come to a bad end.
Wow.
And so this is the comment on the, you know, huge violence used against the revolutionaries to suppress an uprising that really threatened not just the integrity of Imperial Russia, but also the regime itself, the 300-odd-year-old Romanov dynasty. And I find this card extraordinary because it's a prediction 12 years in advance.
I was going to say, how long before the Tsar fell?
Sorry, it's what is it? It's 11 years in advance.
Okay.
Yes, they got it right.
So yes, they did.
They got it right, but I think anyone who understood the situation in Russia realised that this is a rapidly modernising society that was coming under huge pressure. And were it not for the First World War, I have no doubt that actually they would have gradually been a constitutional monarchy introduced. But one can't predict for that. The other extraordinary thing about this postcard is the person who drew it. Very rarely do we actually know the artist of these cards. And this was drawn by someone called Mikhail Chemodanov. Chemodanov was Russia's most famous doctor.
Oh.
So, absolutely extraordinary. He studied at Moscow University with Chekhov and various others and became an illustrator. He had to abandon that due to the pressures of... well-known pressures of bringing up a family because he couldn't earn enough money. But he came back to it in 1905 and he started producing these images. And he was eventually caught.
But you wouldn't produce these for fun. I mean, he must have believed in this.
He was absolutely committed. He was what's known as a populist. He was firmly against the regime. And... He was eventually caught and jailed and he died of tuberculosis that he'd caught some years earlier on.
And has this card been... This presumably would have been an illegal card.
This is completely illegal. This is absolutely the worst.
Can I ask how you know he drew it? I mean, did he sign it? Surely that would have been foolish. Or was it a style thing?
It's funny you should say that. Yes, he did sign some of the early ones. The others are all under a pseudonym, also stylistically, and yes. The method of reproduction. Okay. So this would have been produced illegally in a little studio. Actually, we know exactly where it was produced. It's produced within a stone's throw of the Kremlin. It just, again... You see an image like that, you understand it, but when you bring it back to an individual who risked his life and ultimately, you know, paid the ultimate price for his beliefs, I always find that extraordinary, someone who is prepared to take a stand against tyranny or against, you know, ideologically against, you know, whatever they believe in. And it's probably an appropriate moment to say I don't countenance either revolutionary or czarist belief. And that was a difficult thing, actually, writing the book, to try and take a stance that was, as much as one can, unpartisan.
Yes. Well, and you're not living in early 20th century Russia, so you kind of don't have to.
Very true, but you'd be surprised. There are still some very active supporters of Tsar Nicholas who, you know, really disapprove of the fact of these postcards and the fact they're reproduced. It certainly he has some serious adherents, and the other thing is he's now a saint. So in the Russian Orthodox Church.
Okay. Nicholas's
family, the martyrs who died in 1918, who were murdered in 1918. So from that point of view, I also recognise that, you know, there are sensitivities involved as well.
Yeah. And this wasn't sent openly with a stamp?
Absolutely not, no.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, one of my sort of endless things I try and do in the bits I do with postcards is far less dramatically, but is to try and sort of puncture this myth that postcards are simply a world of coziness and you know, ice cream, and in fact they are simply a way of communicating, and often people can be bitter or sour or resentful, or in this case, wishing death upon the monarch.
They're such amazing communication devices. I mean, as a medium, whether you're, you know, communicating what you did in your holiday or whether you're spreading some sort of ideology, they're fantastic.
Amazing.
Well, because everyone who touches them sees the image.
This is absolutely right. And you can either, you know, pin it to a wall or tell someone you've bought tickets for Carmen.
Yes. And sometimes the message is on the back and sometimes the message is on the front.
Yes.
It kind of depends. And
very true.
I mean, there was just a quick story I picked up from your book, which is Viktor Chernov, the revolutionary, who had this idea. Well, you should tell the story of he had a sort of scheme for sending messages or sending secret messages, didn't he?
Absolutely right. He wrote in his biography about the use of postcards, and he was saying that actually You could send a message on the back, but there was always a danger that the Tsarist authorities might find out what that was. So actually a completely foolproof message was to use the image on the front. Now, this is all very well, but he then goes on to give an example, which is very much not in keeping with modern times. He said, you can send a picture of various men doing things, and that will mean the project has succeeded. But if it's a picture of women, that will mean it's all gone wrong.
Well, there you go.
So, there we go.
Is that sexist or is it just a code? Just a random code?
I think it's deeply sexist.
Deeply, deeply sexist.
I'm not going to argue.
I mean, I agree it is a code, but it's a code that depends on the...
Yes, I suppose it has something underpinning it.
It does.
But interesting as a way...
Yes.
Perhaps we should say you send a picture of a cat if it's... and a dog if it's...
Yes.
Whatever.
I know that.
But which one? Because I don't want any discrimination against dogs, please.
Exactly.
Well, I'm going to lower the tone and bring us back to later in the 20th century briefly now. Just one more from me here. This is a black and white card with a very nice decal edge. You know that's.
Oh, I love the decor edge. Yes.
Really nice. It's an old card. This one. Oh, 1959. Okay. July 1959. Produced by a company called Lily White, and it was sent to Liverpool from Linton. And it's quite hard to read, but we get an insight into. Get inside into their holiday anyway. The talent isn't bad, but not up to expectations. Anne Herbert went climbing today and fell into a pool of water. So Pete took a photograph of her and then helped her out.
I'm just wondering if the word talent means then what it does now.
I think he meant, yes.
You think so?
Yeah, definitely. 50s. And... sometimes I've seen this where you find bits of slang that sound very modern. And so I just wonder if talent was a Liverpool phrase then.
Now it's
become a ubiquitous phrase for, you know, someone attracted to the opposite sex.
But I'm glad he got his priorities straight.
Absolutely. Actually, there's another card here, also a photographic element. This is a bit later. I think we're into the very early 80s, actually, and it's sent from Caister.
Yeah,
not so far from your part of the world. Multi-view. Pictures, definitely 70s with those sort of women with the fair haircuts.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Very good.
The miniskirt and the bell-bottom trousers, can I say?
Yeah. That's a bloke, isn't it? I thought that was a woman.
Is it?
That's two women. No, I think it's a man and a woman.
Oh, well, then, yes.
They've got look-alike sort of David Bowie haircuts.
They have.
It's a rather lovely red singlet he's wearing.
Yes, yes. I couldn't see it.
Put something red on the postcard.
Yes.
Actually, a habit that started with the Russian cars, very frequently using
probably
red.
Probably earlier than that, but yeah.
Anyway, they're saying here, this is Julia saying to her friend in Essex, there is a really nice boy here. I don't know his name yet. I'll try and get a photo of him. Now, I don't know the law, but I think that's stalking, isn't it?
I think it is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast, and my guests today are Toby Matthew and Thane Prince. Thane, what's the second bundle of cards you have for us?
Well, the second bundle of cards are to do with my next interests are employment. I moved from being a nurse to writing about food. It was a very simple jump. I spent quite a lot of time. My husband travelled a lot, and I thought it's time I did something. So I went to City University to take an evening class in journalism. It was close by, you know, and it's because it's just on Goswell Road. And I had thought I would be one of these, you know, ask sister, whatever her name is, you know, my little boy Johnny's got spots, what shall I do about them, in a woman's magazine or something
right.
like that. I sort of thought...
Agony aunt.
Health agony aunt, exactly. Or an agony aunt, but a health agony aunt. And in fact, it was an amazing course and we did terribly well. I loved it to bits. I had never thought about writing before. I'm mildly dyslexic and therefore at school was always taunted by this. And I had a teacher called Miss Lemon, my English teacher, and I long for her to have read my name in print because she was so devastatingly down on the fact that I couldn't spell. And in those days, spelling was hugely important. So,
And dyslexia was far less recognised.
Well, absolutely. You know, I mean, there was even a word for it. You know, I could read, but I couldn't write, and I still can't. I'm trying to learn Spanish at the moment, and it's really, really difficult because you can't see the letters. Anyway, so I started writing about, one of the things the teacher said was, try writing a piece about something you're passionate about. And I was cooking at the time, and so I wrote a piece about that. And by wonderful series of happenstance, I got it published, and from then on went on to write about food. And it's been my enduring passion. I often say that it's incredibly lucky that I write about food, because if I'd been knitting or, you know, potting or something, the whole house would be full of jumpers. couldn't put your arm in the air, all slightly misshapen pots, whereas the worst thing that can happen with food is that you have a slightly difficult meal and you think, well, never mind, tomorrow will be better.
Yeah, everyone benefits really,
and it's not a big deal. So in fact, I found that I had two talents. One is I could cook and the other is I could write. That is the exact length of my talents. I can't draw, I can't sing, I can't dance, but I can cook and I can write. And so I managed very successfully, I hope, to meld the two. And so these are pictures from France. I travelled extensively in France. I used to teach cooking in Italy. And as I say, I now go to Spain quite a lot. And before the internet, and I always make people, you know, young journalists or young food writers, bloggers, laugh when I say this. When I was writing for The Telegraph, I had to have a Rolodex full of important names and telephone numbers. So if I wanted to know how many potatoes they ate in February in Yorkshire, you'd ring the potato marketing board, you'd speak to your contact there, and you'd say, any idea of how many potatoes they eat average week in Yorkshire? Because I'm writing about Yorkshire potatoes. And he would look it up and he would tell you. These days you go onto the internet and you just go, Yorkshire potatoes, how many? And it's all very simple. So you don't have to have the extraordinary amount of reference books, contacts, you know, endless time on the phone. And what you would do when you travelled was I would pick up cards with recipes on so that I didn't have to have the whole book, because I might only want to know how to make confit, which is what this one is, or a gâteau saint-tropezien. And so I would have it as a reference card when I got home.
Because there is a sort of genre, isn't there, of typical recipes from not just France, from various bits of Europe,
absolutely,
I suppose, with just one recipe
with
on them.
One recipe on the front. I've only bought one in today because when I was searching last night, this was the one I found. And I thought it's a wonderful example of its type, because it's got, you know, a sort of bucolic scene it's a rustic scene of a fire. I mean, obviously you wouldn't put that near the fire because the pot would crack, and that pot's meant to be full of fat.
And the flowers as well,
and
right
the flowers,
close to
yes,
it.
Very close to it. And a couple of rather, I think, rather unappealing-looking duck legs there.
Very
I mean, they
yellow.
Don't look very
yeah,
nice,
they've been sat there for a while.
They've been sat there for a while. I don't know, they've just lifted them out of the fat and they're about to roast them in the oven. But it is an interesting idea of the confit, and of course confit goes back to the idea of trying to preserve things, and hence an early interest in preserving, which neatly segues into my more recent books, which were mainly about jams and preserves.
So do you have a collection of cards of these recipes still, of various recipes?
I do, and wouldn't it have been good if I'd bought them in?
No, but we can't bring them all in, you know.
No, but I do, and I have the French seem to be better at it than anyone else. And perhaps that's part of their cultural heritage, their pride in their cuisine.
Yes.
The Italians do quite a lot as well.
Yes, they do. But when I was teaching in Italy, I was mainly teaching in Umbria and rural Tuscany. And they don't have too many shops in Umbria and rural Tuscany.
They're kind of food versions of topographic cards. They tend to be very much associated with a particular location.
This is Périgord. We would only ever get this one in Périgord. It's about confit. So it's confit of duck. I mean, there's gizzard gezier, there's foie. And
have you ever cooked from them?
Yes, not this one, but I have cooked from them.
So you're standing there with it. But then recipe cards were a big thing in the 1970s and 80s, weren't they?
I've got a set of Robert Carrier recipe cards. I mean, when you look at the photography now, they are quite wonderful. But I was looking this morning at something which was talking about making cakes with mayonnaise. And indeed, you can make a perfectly good cake using mayonnaise. The recipe underneath it, which was making a cake with tomato soup, I felt that I probably wouldn't try. But yes, well, mayonnaise has got egg in it.
Yeah, it's
fat. You know, egg and fat. Yeah. That's what you're eating cakes. Why not? Yeah.
Maybe we should popularise the recipe postcard.
Yes, I don't think there are recipe postcards now. I haven't seen.
I can't
see.
You wouldn't have them from this country, would you? You might have one with just a picture of a Cornish pasty on,
or fish and chips, or something.
It wouldn't say how to cook it, I don't think.
Well, no, because I think perhaps we don't have this. I mean, toad in the hole. Perhaps you could. I mean, regional
I've never seen
dishes.
One like that.
No, Eccles cakes.
Or Lancashire hot pot or something.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the postcard manufacturers who are struggling
need to stretch their legs. They need to stretch their legs, yes,
you know,
indeed.
Food is a good market. Zane knows this.
I do indeed.
Very good. And there's a couple of other French cards.
There are. These are old ones of Villeneuve-sur-Lot, and I love them because they are... I mean, I love them because, you know, what you've got in this picture is men at the market...
So these are reproductions of
these
old
are
cards?
Reproductions of old cards, yes. So men at the market or women at the river washing the clothes.
Oh, I see. So once again, we were talking earlier about the division of the sexes.
Yes, we are very much. There are women at the river washing clothes and these are men walking around the market. I mean, I can't see a woman there. There may be one that could be a woman, but basically these are men doing their
bit.
Yes, there's a couple of women there sort of in the distance and these are women. And there are definitely no men washing.
Certainly not.
And you know this place well.
Yes. I spent a lot of time in France. I think it's... we used to sort of bundle the children into the car and sort of drive off ever optimistic. They still have amazing memories of, on the way home, sitting sort of... My daughter the other day said, I'm sure we sat on the cheese. And I said, no, I think I put the cheese around your feet because you'd buy up all these extraordinary things.
I suppose you couldn't help yourself.
Well, you couldn't, no. And you know, my husband would say, we'll never get it all in the car. And I'd say, yes, we will. Yes,
that's a challenge when people say that.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
And presumably the smell on the way back.
Yes, by the time
you arrived.
Absolutely. It was a complete nonsense, but, you know, and of course then you've got so much cheese you can't eat and you don't want to eat cheese anymore.
Tragic. Yeah.
But it's one of those things. So, yes, I spent a lot of time travelling through France, tasting various dishes, trying to work out how people made them, and being enchanted with it. But I'm afraid being slightly less enchanted as the years went on, because I think there are a lot of... issues with the labour laws in France that make food of the type that we instinctively remember very much more difficult to recreate these days.
Really?
Yes, if you can only work a set number of hours a week, how do you run a brigade in a kitchen? They have to be in, you know, if you want to do two meals a day, you basically have to have two brigades, and so it becomes uneconomic. And so a tremendous amount of restaurants struggle with that.
Interesting. Right, well, thank you for your trip to culinary France. Toby, you've got a card now, I think, which is your last one, really.
War, death and destruction.
I happen to know this is pulsating with narrative.
Good.
No, it's true. No, this is a more positive story. So the card is of Yalta in Crimea.
Yes.
And... it's a fairly ordinary topographical card produced in the 1910s, I mean, probably around 1918, 1919. And it's fairly unexciting. But on the back, we've got a little message. And this chap who's written and said, this is where we took the royalty from Russia, April the 7th and 8th, 1919. That was written by a sailor on board HMS Marlborough. And his name was Harry English. And this... Yes, absolutely. This was part of a much larger group of images. And I just picked this out because I thought this was completely extraordinary. So HMS Marlborough was a British warship that helped rescue the surviving members of the Russian royal family, and notably the Dowager Empress, so Nicholas II's mother. And it's hugely emotive to think he was there. And I think this is a wonderful thing about historical documents, and it's why I try and collect where I can, because it brings one back to a part to the past, and it has an immediacy about it. You know, there's even a little spelling mistake. He spelled where as were. Okay. And so you're sort of inhabiting the mind as much as one can do of someone who was present at the most extraordinary time.
Amazing.
And there's all sorts of memoirs and contemporary documents talking about the family, the surviving members, looking back. And this was their last view of Russia.
Oh, almost literally the view we're seeing.
It is extraordinary. I mean, that I'm holding this in my hand.
It does feel like a piece of history, doesn't it?
Oh, I mean, it is. I've come all sort of goosebumpy. It's extraordinary.
I think it very much is. I mean, this is... obviously, it's the distant past, but it certainly informs the present of what happened to Russia in the 20th century. And one can't help but get wrapped up in these incredibly emotive stories, whether that story is of the family itself, whether it's of those who didn't survive, or whether it's of Mr. English himself, who was there serving on beyond the First World War. Again, not a very well-known fact that, you know, the British Army continued to fight, you know, after the end of the First World War. And he went on and fought in parts of modern-day Turkey and Greece and around. It's something that I feel privileged to own. And I think, you know, a lot of collectors talk about this, but one really is just a guardian for future generations, you know, especially with something like this.
And you have to keep it in a box with a label in case you get run over by a bus.
Yes, exactly. But how do you know it's Harry English?
Because it came as a much larger group of images. And I think it was sold, presumably, by a descendant who no longer wanted them. And there we are.
So. And also Crimea. I mean,
very topical, isn't it? It's
isn't
all happening
it? Yes.
Now. Yes.
I mean, we look at this and think that was a long time ago, and then you just say the word Crimea and you think, ah.
Yes, the shifting planes of geopolitics.
Yes.
I think that's true of whether you're talking about the beaching trains and the changes. I think postcards do, you know, bring you back to the past, but there's always the consequences in the present as well.
Yes.
And I think, you know, I certainly, talking about the book, there's no question that postcards now are the focus of academic research, and quite right, because, I mean, you know, where else do you get such a wonderful social snapshot?
Yes.
Whether that's talking about the local talent.
Well, absolutely.
Or bizarre.
Well, yes, and I think this is, you know, talking to academics in this who talk about postcards and do it, they've sort of been ignored for a long time, but suddenly different disciplines have all rather alighted on postcards, whether they're specialists in photography, history of photography, sort of social issues, postal history, anthropology, various different disciplines have all sort of descended on postcards all of a sudden, and quite right too.
Well, it's an extraordinary cross-section, quite unguarded, quite a lot of it. I mean, okay, the coding, obviously, but normally you write on a postcard. I mean, I always say anything on a postcard, you must make sure you, it doesn't matter who reads it, but people write what they're thinking at that time. And
definitely.
So it's not, they're not trying to be bold, they're not trying to be flowery, they're just, you know, this is what's happening. And so, and you get a box of those and you have an enormous snapshot of
and it's
of what's
a resource that of incredible scale.
That's right.
I mean,
incredible scale.
Just look in my garage. But imagine beyond. I mean, they were sent in there millions and millions and billions.
Yes.
So the number, the amount of stuff out there. Now, no one has time to go through it all, but there's a lot of stuff out there, and it's more like it's much more like speech than it is about than it is like writing, really. And
yes.
One of the reasons postcards were kind of frowned upon in the early days is that ordinary people who had a bit of education, or basically could write, could just scrawl anything they liked on them.
Yes.
And it didn't go through all the niceties and the formality of, you know, my dear sir, and with regard to the last letter of the third inst. None of that. It's dear Elsie, we've taken a day trip to Bognor. It's fantastic. Or, no, it's A1 and we're in the pink.
Or having a wonderful time, wish you were here.
Yeah.
The traditional.
That's all the it classic.
Means. Yes. That's all
or
it means.
My room is marked with a cross, you know, these sort of things. That, those wonderful ones.
But then again, this is, you know, he obviously thought it was serious enough, didn't he, to make that note on it in his own informal way.
Very much so, yes. I mean, and I think that's the other thing about postcards is they're personal records for individuals.
Yes.
And one mustn't forget, and I think in the context of the Russian cards, this is very much true, that actually this was your personal art gallery.
Oh.
And it was both a record of your aesthetic sense, but also a record of your own personal history, as in this case.
Yes.
And so they weren't just sent through the post. They were also put in albums and stored away.
Well, I still buy reproductions of pictures that I have seen for the first time at an exhibition.
Yes.
And I have quite a lot of them. And I mean, I was in Norway last year and I bought some new Munch postcards because then I will have them.
Yeah.
I don't want the book, but I want to have a memory of those postcards. So I still use it for that same reason.
I have the same, but I rather wonder what to do with them. They're sort of stuffed away in a drawer and I never look at them. And I think, well,
I have a box.
You know.
When the Tate Modern opened in the shop, an artist, I don't remember the name of the artist, he had created these narrow steel shelves that you could put on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I did buy them, didn't I? But they were designed literally just for putting
for postcards.
As a moving display.
Oh, right.
In the way a lot of writers have, you know, or just if you're at your desk and you want some inspiration, and it might be something that's sort of has a sentimental connection, it might you just like your picture of Munch.
Yeah.
And so they did this, but then lots of people have cards stacked around their room.
Yes, they do.
I was talking to a writer the other day in this room, and she said she had to have all her postcards behind her. She'd just stare
at them, not
do any work.
Well, no, absolutely. Yeah, that is an... You know, do you not find that? That you're distracted by things when you're writing?
Very much so, yes. I can't. I mean, I'd love to have a nice window in front of me with a beautiful view, but I can't. I need to stare at a blank wall.
Exactly.
Otherwise nothing gets done.
And reflect back into yourself, into your brain.
Indeed.
Well, that's very good. Thank you so much, both of you, for sharing these really interesting and different and strange and unusual and touching cards with us. Another quick reminder for everyone at home, the cards that sent us hurtling into these strange personal and historical stories are all going to be on the blog. Images will be on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can have a look for yourself, including one last one from me in the past postcard style, and it does feel a bit trivial. Though in some ways it has a connection with Toby's last card, because yours was very much a record of a piece of history. This is a sort of sideline on a moment that could be history, but perhaps isn't. Maybe it's history as we actually experience it. It's a card from Scilly Isles, a multi-view with some daffodils in the middle. It's from, well, it's certainly 70s, because it's a sevenpenny stamp sent to Devon by someone called Diana and Robert and family. And on their holiday, they said, "Today, in Isles of Scilly, we saw Sir Harold Wilson and Bill Oddy of the Goodies."
Lucky them.
Yeah. I mean, Harold Wilson you'd expect to, because he was famous for going on holiday there.
He was.
Bill Oddy, maybe he was bird watching.
Bird watching.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say.
There you are. We'll have to get Bill on and ask him if he remembers that day. And before we let Thane and Toby back out into what is genuinely sunshine, I've got just one more postcard for you both. It's customary for us to end the programme on one of these. I don't know if you've seen one of these before.
Never.
Oh, yes, I have. Absolutely. I'm not this particular one, but I have seen... Is this a record? Would you put it on an actual turntable and play it? Yes.
It's a musical postcard.
I'm that much older than you. You see, steam trains, remember? Yes.
The singing postcard. Use it as a normal record.
That's right.
Yeah, wow. If you don't mind ruining your stylus.
Exactly. Send it through the post. I think that the idea of printing records on paper was something that was big in the 70s.
Yeah, these I think were from the 60s. Late 60s.
Yeah, perhaps it was
there
the
were
60s.
Musical postcards as far back as the 1900s, where they were printing them onto a sort of I don't know what it was like. Like a sort of shellac, I suppose.
Mm. This is
the important question.
Well, have you played it?
Young Tom is busy next door, but if we ask him nicely, he might come through and we'll see if we can do something with it. It's a bit scratchy. There we go. I think sometimes these were sent in envelopes and sometimes they
very
were sent literally through
though.
The post.
Yeah, it's very jolly.
Something going on.
Yeah,
it makes
one
want to dance a little.
Absolutely.
Possibly not in a gondolier, but...
Is it an accordion?
I think it is, yeah. Oh. Yeah, it's Italian accordion.
Yes.
I could imagine sitting in Venice listening to this.
Yeah, it's quite slow.
Can I?
Relaxing as the sun sets.
With a
drink.
A glass of something.
Oh, I said that too quickly.
I was just, you know, but I was there with you.
Well, as the Bridge of Sighs rotates at 78 RPM, that's it for this time on Podcast from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first-class guests for sharing the postcards from their pasts, Toby Matthew and Thane Prince. Thank you both.
Very lovely to be here.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me, @PastPostcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardorstudios.co.uk.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.